Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, according to my third guest today, Audrey Levitino, women aren't just following the farming movement, they're actually leading the farming revolution. We'll talk to her about woman-powered farm, a manual. Her new book is called A Woman-Powered Farm, a manual for a self-sufficient lifestyle from homestead to field. Very interesting. We'll also talk with Kristen Woodson-Harvey about her new novel, A Southern Tale That Proves Families Are Made, Not Born, and that while life circumstances may shape us, they definitely do not determine our future. And talking of futures, too many young people today believe their futures are determined by the universities they're accepted to or rejected by. And my first guest is here to debunk that myth and tell us that's not so. He is Frank Bruni, whose high-profile career at the New York Times has spanned two decades. He's been the paper's chief restaurant critic, its Rome bureau chief, a White House correspondent, lead reporter covering George W. Bush's 2000 presidential campaign, and a staff writer for the New York Times Sunday magazine. Since 2011, he's been an op-ed columnist focusing on a range of subjects, including higher education. He's the author of two best-selling books called The Memoir, Born Round, and Ambling Into History. And his latest book is called Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to College Admissions Mania. Frank Bruni, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And let's start with this. You say the name of the book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. And you say Americans need to hear that. Tell us how you got interested in this and why we need to hear that.
Well, I've just been watching the children of friends and my nieces and nephews go through the college admissions process over recent years. And it's a process unrecognizable from when I went through it 25, 30 years ago. It was pretty intense then. But these days, There's a frenzied nature to it. There's a kind of desperation brought to it, all of which are predicated on the idea that if you get into a quote-unquote elite university or college, your life is going to be made, and if you don't, you're going to be behind the eight ball and at a disadvantage forevermore. And I've been watching that happen. I've been watching that psychology take hold, and yet I look at the successful people around me. I reflect on the hundreds of successful people I've interviewed over my career as a journalist, and they have many different kinds of educational backgrounds and pedigrees. Some of them went to fancy schools, some of them did not. And so I think that all of the obsessiveness that people are bringing to the process right now is predicated on a bit of misinformation, and that misinformation is that you need to go to a fancy elite selective school to get ahead in life. It's just not true.
Do you think this is an American phenomenon? I see it a little in Europe, but I don't see it anywhere near as much as we do in America. What's your take on that?
I'm no expert on what happens in Europe or other places. I mean, I know to the extent that they're on my radar, it's that they feed American universities more than before. We take more international students. But from what I have seen, I lived in Italy for a while, this is largely an American phenomenon. I say largely because actually there are a number of Asian countries,
right,
in which the kind of college admissions university system is similarly laced with anxiety. People mention Japan to me all the time.
Yes.
That's one internally in terms of what happens within Japan. But then I also know from, even just from emails I get and inquiries I get, I know that in South Korea and in China, there is enormous ambition to come to some of America's best universities. There are more and more of those kids coming, for instance, to American prep schools, boarding schools, with the hope of getting on the track of going to one of these elite universities. So certainly in China and South Korea, you see some of this psychology, if not a lot of this psychology.
So what do you talk in the first chapter about people that you explored their background. Some of them were Pulitzer Prize winners, and many of those did not go to what we call the Ivy League. One of those that I thought was kind of interesting was a colleague of yours who won he said he went to Sunny Binghamton. Do you know the story I'm talking of?
State University of New York at Binghamton.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, he did all kinds of things, like to put himself through school. So tell us a little bit about what he went through and the success that he's had following that. And why?
Well, I mentioned him. His name is David Kushinevsky, and I mentioned him because last year at around this time, the spring semester of 2014, he and I were both guest fellow professors at Princeton. Each of us taught a different journalism/nonfiction writing course there. And in his case, he used to chuckle at the fact that he had applied to Princeton when he himself had been looking to go to college, and he applied to some other Ivy League universities, and all of them had turned him down. And here he was teaching at Princeton, and he thought that was just kind of one of those little ironies of life. He went to a state university because even though he was paying the lesser tuition of a state university, was still someone who had to kind of scrape and save to get through college. He worked as a janitor 15 hours a week. Did other odd jobs right after college. As he was first trying to make his way in journalism, drove a Mr. Softy ice cream truck for a while, and yet ended up at the New York Times, ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize in the category of explanatory reporting. And the point of his story, of which there are dozens in the book and hundreds of thousands in life, is that if you've got drive, if you've got determination, you can get where you're going to go, and often not traveling the route of a fancy elite university may give you a kind of scrappiness that really serves you well, and that's what I saw in him.
Yeah. There are a lot of great success stories in here. I mean, right in the introduction, you start off with Peter Hart, I believe his name was, who said, you know, he was pretty devastated when he didn't get into the school of his choice, but he said, "I got to be the big fish in a small pond," something my dad always preferred a position to be in. He always preferred to be the big fish in a small pond. Do you think there's value to that? And certainly in Peter's case, there was.
Yeah, I think there can be great value in that. It depends utterly on the person, you know, and how they respond to the situation. I mean, if I have any message beyond all others in the book, is that there's no one path or one answer for every person. And so that's why I wouldn't say, yes, it's always great to be a big fish in a small pond. But for some young men and women, that has, in fact, been the case. And I was struck, as I interviewed people for the book, by how many young men and young women I met and interviewed who had found that the smaller pond, so to speak, of a less selective, less envied school turned out to be a really great fit for them because they caught the notice of teachers in a way they might not have at a different school. They felt a confidence and developed a swagger that they might not have at a different school. And so it just hammers home the point that there is no one way, there is no single recipe for success and achievement.
Right. I think for me, one of the significant things that he said was that he felt really competent at this school, whereas, you know, if he'd gone to an Ivy League, he maybe might not have spoken up so much. And he felt that he could now swim with the sharks, so it certainly seemed to give him a huge boost of confidence. How many people did you speak to when you were putting the book together?
Oh, you know, scores of people, because I spoke to people in many different categories. And I spoke to college and university presidents and administrators and admissions people about that end of things. I spoke to a lot of successful businessmen or artists or whatever about how college had or hadn't factored into what they did. You know, then I spoke to people like Peter Hart, whom we were just mentioning, who, you know, just people who'd been through the college admissions experience and through college recently, and had some interesting reflections on how it all played out for them. So, I mean, when you put together all those different categories, other experts, I mean, scores of people.
Yeah, this is another story I loved. Jana Leahy, she was 26, she went through the college admissions process. She wanted to get into Claremont McKenna College and didn't. But she had a whole turnaround in her perspective. She said she, you know, on reflection, she never would have had the strength, drive, or fearlessness to take the risk. She opened a school, co-founded a school. Tell us a little bit about her story, because I thought that was a really great story.
Well, Jenna had gone to a very, you know, venerable private boarding school. She actually didn't board there because she lived nearby, so she was a day student. But she went to the X Phillips Exeter Academy, which is one of our most, you know, venerated prep schools, and was quite a good student there, but had had very very mediocre college board scores, and so didn't end up getting into a lot of the schools that she thought she belonged at. And it was in real time for those, you know, weeks or months when she was absorbing it. It was quite devastating to her. But because of it, when she went to the school she ended up at, which was Scripps College in Southern California, she just sort of, she got there, she liked the school, she liked the campus, she found that she really wasn't heartbroken for a very long time, and it made her realize that, oh, you can be rejected, and you can survive it, right, and actually feel okay on the far side of it. And she believes that because of that, she took all of these chances and all of these risks that she might not otherwise have taken. She just applied fearlessly to things. There was some competition involving involving time with Jimmy Carter and the Carter Foundation. She applied for that. She got it. She ended up applying to get into Teach for America, which is a very, very competitive program. She got into that. And then as she was finishing that, or just after she finished that, she actually applied for an enormous grant to start her own charter school in the Phoenix area of Arizona where she'd settled. And she got that. And when she reflects on all the years that I'm describing, she believes that that period of being so rejected or feeling so rejected by colleges and then kind of waking up on the far side of it and realizing, hey, I'm still standing and life really isn't so crappy, it's kind of still fine, it made her appreciate the value in taking risks, because if the risk didn't pan out, it wasn't the end of the world.
Right, that's a great story. And she certainly sounded really passionate about what she's doing now. You talk in the book at length about some of the essays and some of that are submitted and some of the fickle way in which admissions counselors and advisors will look and accept or reject applications. But you say at the end of the day, it's all madness. It's utter nonsense. You say, for one thing, the admissions game is too flawed to be given so much credit. So let's talk about that. What is so flawed about it, and can we correct it?
Well, it's flawed in the sense that people aren't really competing on an even playing field. So, you know, if you're talking about one of these extremely selective schools with a very finite number of places, of course, in their freshman class, a certain number of those spots are going to go to athletes. A large number of those spots are going to go to athletes because those schools field teams in various sports. And once you field a team in a sport, you want that team to be competitive, you know, if it can be. And so if you are not someone who's got an athletic skill that fits into the school, already you are not being judged. The rest of your application is not being judged in the same way as one of those athletes' applications. There are people who are legacy cases, whose parents or grandparents or both went to the school, and they've been given a sort of extra consideration. There are sorts of minorities that aren't fully represented at the school, and so if someone is a strong applicant who also happens to be one of those minorities, that person is going to have an edge. So if you're looking at what that admissions committee says as some sort of objective, neutral judgment of your worth, that's just crazy. On top of which, it's looking, that admissions committee is looking at things like board scores. Some people perform well on tests, some don't. Mm-hmm. Board scores can absolutely be improved by a lot of private tutoring and private classes and that sort of thing. So that's not really an even playing field either. And then there are a lot of people who just do not hit their strides, who don't bloom in the high school years, but they bloom much later on. And so it's so important to say to a young person, well, it makes great sense to try to have as distinguished a high school career as you can. And while it's certainly a compliment to you if one of these selective schools says, hey, we think you spent your years well, here you go, come on aboard, if you do not get that sort of invitation, if you're not accepted, if that's not the kind of school you can get into, it doesn't mean you're a lesser person or you've got a lesser destiny. I mean, it's just foolish to let kids worry that that's the message that the school is sending.
Yeah, and I think so much of this comes from parents in certain cases, and you share a great story where two parents wrote to their son, Matt. They wrote him a letter saying, regardless of what happens, we love you more than anything and we support you wherever you go, before the process, right?
Yes, what they did, which was really lovely, is they saw he had applied to many, many schools, as kids do today. They apply to too many schools. And he was from a New York City suburb where there's a lot of heated academic competition, and the kids are very ambitious and very able. And they just saw in the days that he was waiting for the acceptance or rejection notice from these schools, they saw how worked up he was getting, how anxious he was, how anxious all of his friends were. And they thought, we need to tell him before these schools say yes or no, before we're in a position where it seems like we're trying to console him. We need to let him know that whether this goes fantastically in terms of him getting what he wants or whether it doesn't, we love him regardless, and we esteem him as a human being the same anyway. And so they wrote a letter saying all of that to him, letting him know that they thought he'd be a great success wherever he ended up and would be as proud of him if he got into only one of these schools as if he got into all of them. And they gave him that letter sealed before any of the schools rendered their verdicts or announced their verdicts, so that he would know they'd written the sentiment not as an act of consolation,
right,
but even before it was at all clear what was going to happen.
I love it. Well, the book is called Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania. Frank Bruni, a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Final thought, take all of this energy that you spend on figuring out how to get into a school and redirect it to a much more meaningful conversation, question, consideration of how you're going to use the extraordinary blessing of college. Successful people are people who used their college years well, not necessarily people who went to a fancy school.
Perfect. Thanks so much for being with us today, Frank. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
The book, again, is called Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. Frank Bruni, my guest. Please stay with us. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a PAWS foster care volunteer. For more information, visit PAWS.org or 425-787-2500. PAWS.org or 425-787-2500.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, my next guest is Christy Woodson Harvey. She holds a degree in journalism and mass communications and a master's in English. She writes about interior design and today joins us to talk about her debut novel, Dear Carolina. Christy Woodson Harvey, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicky. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you. It's always nice to catch somebody on a debut novel, especially when it's so well written and so well packaged. And you've obviously worked very hard on this. I know it didn't come easy to you. Tell us about how this all started for you, because I know this particular book was picked up in a competition, correct?
It was, yes. Seems kind of unlikely now looking back on it, but I'd always been a writer. You know, like you said, I went to journalism school and had always thought, you know, I'll grow up and I'll work for a magazine, and that was kind of the path I was on. And I met my husband, and he was a dentist in New Bern, North Carolina. So that was not really going to work out very well for my New York magazine writing plan. So I actually ended up taking a totally different job working in finance of all the random things on earth, and then sort of made my way back to freelancing. And just kind of on a whim one day, I thought, you know, I'm going to see if I can write a novel. And it was just not something that I had really planned on doing, but I thought I would do it. And I actually wrote two what I call sort of practice novels before I really even kind of sent anything out into the world. Then I actually wrote another novel that I signed with an agent for right about the time that I was finishing Dear Carolina. And so my agent was shopping the third manuscript, and I sent Dear Carolina to a writing contest just because there were some great judges and I knew they'd give me some great feedback. And my now editor found the book in the contest, and that's kind of how she became interested in it. So that was not how I expected it to happen, but I was so excited. You know, I'll take it however it comes.
So Dear Carolina, which wasn't the book being shopped, gets published first. Is the other book coming out second?
No. The second book I have coming out is actually one that I wrote afterwards. You know, the one that I wrote before is a bit of a prequel to Dear Carolina. It's all about Khaki, who's one of the main characters in Dear Carolina. It's sort of Khaki's story. And I love that book, and it will always kind of have a special place in my heart, but I'm not sure that it is as strong as Dear Carolina or Lies and Other Acts of Love, which is my next book coming out. So I think I'll just sort of keep it on the shelf and be happy for the experience, but I'm not sure that it will ever actually come out.
There you go. Well, you never know, because Neil Simon kept a play in his drawer for 10 years. And when he was cleaning out his drawers one day, he came across this manuscript and thought, oh, what is this? Started reading it, thought, well, this is pretty good. And it was Brighton Beach Memoirs, which I think his most famous one. So you never know.
Well, you never know. And I could always rewrite it, you know, but we'll see. Maybe Dear Carolina will just be a smashing success and people will be dying to read more about Khaki. So you just never know.
Well, let's talk about Khaki. Frances Mason is her name. She's a thriving interior designer. You also write about design. So did you build Khaki around you somewhat?
I've gotten that question a lot. I don't know that I necessarily built her around me. I think her upbringing is very different from mine. A lot of her experiences are very different from mine. But no doubt about it. I mean, my day in and day out writing about interior design and learning about it and being very interested in it definitely influenced her character. And there are snippets of her, snippets of me here and there in her for sure. But I wouldn't necessarily say that she was based on me.
Okay. So the book is two mothers writing to Dear Carolina, the birth mother and the adoptive mother. Frances Mason is one of the women. Jody is the other. Tell us a little bit about Jody.
Well, Jody just has had a really tough life. She, you know, has this alcoholic mother who was just kind of never really there for her, and she has a wonderful father, but he passes away when she's in her teenage years, and she sort of finds herself repeating this cycle of addiction that has been in her family. And when we sort of meet Jody, she has just gotten out of rehab, and she's living with this kind of no-good guy who probably is not the best influence on her, and she finds out that she's pregnant, and she just knows that she can't have this baby. She just doesn't think she's strong enough. And so Khaki is actually one of the ones that says, you know, we'll help you. Jody is Khaki's husband's cousin. So Khaki's husband is Graham, and Jody is Graham's cousin. So Khaki says, you know, we'll help you, and you can do this. And, you know, her friends kind of rally around her, and she decides, you know, I'm going to take a chance, and I'm going to do this. But, you know, as she sort of enters into this motherhood journey and really realizes what all it entails, she kind of feels those old demons coming back, and she's really worried about, you know, maintaining her sobriety and being the mother that her daughter really needs. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of Jody's story. The characters are very different on the surface, but I think as you get to know them a little bit, they have a lot of the same heart, which I think is kind of neat, that they just, you know, they're from these two totally different worlds, but these women connect with each other on so many different levels and really kind of become a family.
Right. So when you were writing this, I heard that the idea sparked for this actually after your son was born. How did it develop for you?
It was just a really strange thing. I'd already written a couple of books, so I think, you know, you're a writer, so you know how this goes, but As you're writing, I think kind of book ideas are sort of always in the back of your mind. And he had been home from the hospital for just a couple of days, and my parents were staying with us and kind of helping us get some sleep. And, you know, I'd fed him and changed him, and I knew he was fine, but I could just hear him crying, and I couldn't stand it. And so I got up, and my dad handed him to me, and he just quit crying. And I just remember having this moment and thinking, like, wow, like everyone tells you that you're going to love this child more than you can possibly imagine, and so you expect that, but I don't think I was prepared for just this bond that we had, that he had with me, you know, that he was just hours old and he knew I was his mother. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I was really prepared for that, and I almost had this kind of, I say, like a life flashing before your eyes moment, except it wasn't my life, it was this book. And I just remember just thinking, you know, what would it be like to have to part with this person, and what would have to happen in your life in order for you to make that decision? Because it is so selfless. I mean, that is the biggest gift that you could give another woman, is your child. And so I just remember kind of thinking that. And then on the flip side of that, wondering, you know, being a mother and having a biological child already, and knowing that, you know, your adoptive child had this deep connection with this other woman, you know, what would that feel like? And it kind of all, I don't know, it was just all right in that moment, and Khaki and Jody just sort of came to me right then, and I sat with them for a while. I didn't write them right away. Obviously, I had a baby that was a couple days old.
I read that those sleepless nights helped you start writing.
They absolutely did. I mean, the child did not sleep at all for 18 months, like not more than a two-hour stretch. And so some nights I would just stay up and write because I would think, well, what's the point? I mean, I'm not going to get any sleep anyway.
Right.
So I do sort of credit him for this novel, and definitely for me getting an agent, because I wrote query letters like in the middle of the night and sent them out. So
there you go. There you go, making the most of it. So you talk about a lot of different issues in the book: alcoholism, single motherhood, adoption, obviously, possibility of abortion, marriage, infertility, the lot of issues. But you also say this book was 100% driven by the characters, not by the issues. So let's talk about how you got the idea for Francis and Jody. That came to you and you sat with it for a while. Did you then outline the story? Did it kind of flow as you were writing it? How does that work for you?
I did not. I have never been an outliner. I mean, I remember being, even like back in high school and even probably middle school, when you would have to, you know, you get an assignment, you'd have to turn in your outline with the essay. I would have to write the essay and then go back and do the outline, because I just don't, I don't process in that way. That's just not how I work. I'm going to speak to a few schools, and they are going to hate me if I say that, so I'm going to try to keep that to myself. But I really, the first scene of the book that just kind of grabbed me and wouldn't let go is the scene where Jody is on the beach, and she's kind of trying to come to terms with this decision that she knows is the right thing, but she's just not sure if she can bring herself to do it. And she says, you know, that it's the line where she says, love is the hardest equation, and she's, you know, kind of grappling with this decision. And that was the very first scene of the book that I wrote, and it's kind of smack dab in the middle. So I wrote that one, and then, I don't know, there are always key scenes in the story that I've played out in my head over and over again, or dialogue, or certain things that are happening with the characters, and that's usually where I tend to start. And I write those kind of key scenes, and it's interesting because, you know, one will lead to another, will lead to another, will lead to another, and then by the time I'm finished with that, I sort of puzzle piece them all together in the order that they should be in chronologically, which is a disaster, as you can probably imagine, especially in a book like this when you're writing about crops and growing seasons and food, and it was not good.
Well, Jody has at the end of the book, if I can just find it, and of course I can't right now, but she says there's nothing better than seeing your name up at the farmer's market. My next guest is a farmer. But so tell us a bit about how the characters evolved from the beginning. You know, everything was great with Khaki, but she was missing this second child. And so what kind of evolution did Jody go through?
Well, I mean, I knew that Jody was going to be, you know, this character that had a lot of scars, but that she also had a lot of hope, and she had a lot of dreams and a lot of wisdom for her age, that, you know, life had kind of not necessarily dealt her the best hand, but that she was just that kind of girl that was going to be okay. You know, she was going to make it, and she was somehow going to make it work, and this was all going to kind of, you know, work out for her in the end, and she was going to be okay because she was just this really strong woman, but she didn't really know it yet. And I think, you know, she had such a connection with the earth that was just her, you know, I guess something that her grandmother instilled in her from a very young age. But even on a deeper level than that, it was just something that even from that very young age, she just felt it, like in a way that maybe not everyone does. She just felt that really deep connection with the earth. And I'll be totally honest with you, I was writing her and I was thinking, God, Jody, please do something else. I don't know anything about this stuff. Like, what am I going to do? And I mean, I certainly, you know, I love our local farmers market, and I'm really lucky because the town where we live, I get to, you know, go out to all our local farms and get our food right when it's picked and take my little boy out and we, you know, pick our dinner, and it's amazing. But I didn't know a lot about, you know, the things that she writes about in this book, about canning and cooking and growing seasons and all these types of things. So I had to do a lot of research for Jody's character, but I'm very fortunate because the area where I live, there is, I mean, you can just sort of throw a rock and there are just a million people who are so knowledgeable about all of these things. So it wasn't that difficult, and it was very, very fun for me to get to learn how to make jam and, you know, can vegetables, and I had a great time doing it. But there were definitely moments when I thought, can't you just be really into something that I know about? This would be really a lot easier for me.
So do you, when you finish the book, I've heard people say it's like giving birth to a baby, and there's this, yeah, it's all anticlimactic afterward. Yeah. Did you feel that somewhat, since this is your first go around, really, even though you've written three, I think you said, but your first go around in actually getting it published and getting it released, and now, of course, you're going out promoting it. How did that feel? You sound very excited and very passionate, which is lovely to hear. But does it feel?
I am so excited. I cannot wait. You know, I hear authors all the time say, I love to write, but I hate the promotion. And I'm like, bring it on. I cannot wait. Like, I want to go out and meet readers and talk about this book. And, you know, I'm so excited to get to kind of release this book baby into the world. It's, you know, the book comes out tomorrow, so I actually have sort of felt like today, it's almost more like the day before your wedding day, because you know it's coming,
mm-hmm.
and you've been planning it for months, and you're really excited, and you don't exactly know how it's going to go, but you're excited anyway.
Well, we're excited to have had you here today, and you've got a great website. It is, let me see, ChristyWoodsonHarvey.com. This is a good one. It's your name, ChristyWoodsonHarvey.com, and Christy is spelt with a K. And you can find out more about Christy Woodson Harvey there. What would you like to leave our listeners with? A very quick final thought, Christy.
Okay, just thank you to everyone who reads Dear Carolina. It's on sale tomorrow, May 5th, and I'm just so excited to hear what you think.
Thanks so much for being with us. It's great.
Thank
and
you.
I hope the rest of your tour goes absolutely fantastic for you. We look forward to having your new book, your next book, come out.
Thank you, Vicky.
And again,
have a good day.
Thanks. You can find out more about Christy at ChristyWoodsonHarvey.com. The book, again, Dear Carolina, it's a Southern novel. Jody Thomas, New York Times bestselling author, said characters with rich, complicated lives beautifully shows how a family comes to be. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live. We will be right back.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Peggy Kaler at Westar Pacific Mortgage in Duval, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 10th, it's a Talk with Your Animals Sunday with gifted animal communicator, medium, and Reiki master, Darcy Pariso. Darcy can help you talk with and learn about your animal friends or help you connect with animal or human loved ones on the other side. So plan to give us a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Dr. Mitchell Gaynor shares how you can change your destiny and reverse certain diseases with the Gene Therapy Plan. Also, Linda Zoana shares stories from people living with Meniere's disease in her new book, Vertigo, When Your World Spins Out of Control. Keep up with show news on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and follow us on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair. Be sure and tune in every Monday at noon for Conversations Live.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Now I'm a farmer, and I'm digging, 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 digging. Now I'm a farmer.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we went from having a fictional character who was into a farmer's market into now my next guest is actually a woman farmer. So her name is Audrey Levitino. She's the quintessential modern woman farmer. 13 years ago, she left the urban world to fulfill her dream of self-employment in a natural, healthy environment. She now runs a 23-acre farm, which is called Ted's Last Stand near Gordonsville, Virginia. And she and her husband, Michael, are the co-authors of The Joy of Hobby Farming. Her new book is called Woman Powered Farm, a manual for a self-sufficient lifestyle from homestead to field. Audrey Levitino, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be on air with you.
And it's great to have you here. And I just checked with you during the break to make sure someone's taking care of the farm while you're spending time with us, because I know nature doesn't stand still for anyone.
Well, you really hit on one of the big things that can be a downfall if you do decide to be a farmer. It is really, really tough to get away. So that is something to consider.
So let's start with a little of your background, Audrey. You were a high school English teacher. Quite a transition there. Was this something that you'd always wanted to do? Was it, what sparked it for you?
Yeah, well, it was not something that had always been in the back of my mind. I mean, I've always enjoyed having just a little garden or pots on a balcony when that was all that I had. But I never really imagined myself as running my own little farm. I think what sort of sparked that interest was moving to Virginia, Central Virginia, where the land is just so amazingly beautiful and things really like to grow here. So when we moved here and bought our little farm, I went ahead and got a teaching job. That was my career, and was doing that and enjoying it. But slowly but surely, it became harder and harder for me to spend time inside rather than being outside on my farm. And eventually, I just kind of decided, well, if I'm going to make a switch, I need to do it soon. And and that's what happened. I just decided, let's give it a try. Let's use this piece of land to grow food and grow flowers and create a sustainable ecosystem and see what happens. So,
and you're not alone, because according to the USDA, some statistics here for our listeners, women are the most rapidly growing segment of the farming population, accounting for more than 30% of all farmers. Today, there are more than 1 million women working on farms, a number that's doubled since 1982. And female-run farms generate $13 billion worth of produce a year.
Yes, isn't that incredible? And I think that it's actually, really, if they were to count all of the ways that women farm, that it would be more than $13 billion. When you think about all of the new urban gardens and community gardens that are springing up and how much food they create in those small spaces, and that doesn't get counted in the census.
Right.
And most of those are run by women. So I think the numbers are actually even larger, and it's quite exciting.
So you've called this a woman-powered farm. Why not just farming, a guide for farmers
right.
in general? You know, are you speaking to women differently than you might speak to male farmers?
A little bit, yeah. And I do. I was concerned at the beginning with writing this book and thinking, oh, it's going to really turn away, you know, men, and then they're not going to want to look at it, and it's going to seem prejudiced, you know, in favor of women. But that's really not the point at all. The point is to address a lot of issues in this book that haven't been addressed for women in previous books. When I was learning how to farm and even in doing the research for this book, it was really hard to find any sort of step-by-step guides for a woman to do these daily tasks on the farm, like building a fence. How do you go about that? What's the procedure? I couldn't find that. I was lucky that I had neighbors and other farmers that helped me with that, and my husband helped me, but I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a manual, kind of like the Dare to Repair book that's geared towards women, that gives you these step-by-step, and we have lots of, my husband took these great pictures, lots of pictures that show you exactly how to do some of the things that you maybe never thought you would be doing.
I love those pictures. I was looking at all the pictures of the flowers, and then you drive in the tractor on a sunny day, and I thought, boy, that looks a great lifestyle. And then I saw pictures of you changing a tire and
digging,
fixing this yeah. and fixing that. And I thought, okay, that gives me a fuller perspective.
Yeah, so two sides to the coin, right? Two sides. It's easy to romanticize it, and there are days when I just look around and go, "Man, I am so lucky," and then other days when I'm just like, "Oh no, this is just not what I want to be doing right now." So when
you started out, your husband and you did it together. I understand. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And now you've taken over.
Right. Michael's job has gotten much more complex and time-consuming, and my business has grown, and so it's kind of my responsibility, if I want to keep doing this, to keep the farm running, and so I have taken on these chores that before I never really, like driving that big tractor, I was really not that interested in doing that, but it was something I needed to learn how to do.
And so if somebody were thinking, you know, we have beautiful country out here in the Pacific Northwest, of course.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we
yeah.
have listeners across the states. If they're sitting there thinking, boy, you know, I've always wanted to do something with this piece of land, what do you tell them? How should they start beginning? And, of course, it depends on what they want to grow, where they see themselves going. But what's a good place to start? Because you were 40, I understand, when you began yours.
Yes, I was 40. And that's kind of a big difference. I think now, especially after interviewing all of these women farmers for this book and for the profiles that are in the book and interviewing some of the interns, I would have tried to either intern or at least spend time on an actual working farm so that you really get a feel for what you're getting yourself into. And not only that, but you make connections with people who have been doing this and can teach you things that you really, you know, I learned a lot by trial and error, and I think I could have avoided a lot of those mistakes had I done something like an internship or a farm shadowing, something like that. So I would recommend that to people, especially younger people that are adventurous and would like to do that. The other thing that I recommend to everyone, no matter what age you are, is, you know, have a goal in mind, but start small, because it's easier to recover from something that goes wrong if you started small. Most of the equipment that we bought for our farm, we bought used, and also, you know, so equipment is very expensive. Land is expensive. You can lease land, or you can be sort of farm someone's land that, you know, they'd like to have something done with it, but they don't want to farm it.
That's a good idea. That's a good way to start.
Exactly. So to make sure, because it can be, it might not be what you think it is. It is really tough work, or you could get hurt, and then, you know, you're stuck with a lot of stuff. So
yeah.
Something to think about in terms of starting small, making sure that you're in the right type of farming. Maybe you don't want, you know, you thought you wanted to grow vegetables, and then you realize, wow, I really want to raise goats. So it gives you a chance to experiment without, you know, throwing everything into one pot.
Right. And you, this book is so full of tips. I mean, some really great tips. As I said, looking through here, it's very visual, lots of pictures in here. You really show people how to do just about everything you need to know, I would think, to get going. One of the things that surprised me, because I've always thought if I have land, I love horses, so I'd have horses, but I'd also like llamas,
right.
Llamas or alpacas. I didn't know that from a farm perspective, there's quite a significant difference between llamas and alpacas. What's the difference there?
Oh, yes. Very much so. I mean, the alpacas are probably going to make you much more money because their fleece is a much more high-grade fleece. Llamas, although I did try to spin their wool, I took a class and was very excited about it. It turns out llamas have actually two types of hair. Because they were bred as pack and guard animals, they actually have one layer of hair on top that's the guard hair, which helps protect them from the weather. It actually repels water and it's more of an insulator. And then under that is their fleece. But they mix together, and so after you shear your llamas, you have to separate the guard hair from the fleece before you can wash and process the fleece in order to spin it. So that's kind of a big process, and mills, at least the mills around here in central Virginia where I live, won't even take llama fleece because of that aspect, whereas alpacas are bred for their fleece. And they're smaller animals, so you can probably have more of them. But if you do have alpacas, you probably want to get a llama to guard them because alpacas are vulnerable to predators.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And the llamas will kick up a noise. They act as a guard dog, if you will.
Oh,
is
yes,
that right?
They're amazing guard animals. People have terrible problems with deer in this area, and I don't have any trouble with deer. In fact, I've seen my llamas get their nose to the ground and chase rabbits out of our field. They take their job very seriously.
They do. I guess they do. So we don't have a great deal of time, but could you give us a couple of best practices for selling at farmers markets? Because this era is full of people who make things like artisan jams or they make them for their family, and their family says, you really should sell these. So a couple of tips for...
Right. Yeah. And that's the way some of these gardeners get started, too. They're like, wow, these are the best strawberries, or this is the best food. You should grow more and sell it. And, you know, yes, best practices, well, go and visit the farmers markets in your area and figure out which one you really like, and then talk to the other vendors. Talk to the people running the market. A lot of times there's a huge waiting list, but you can probably get in as an alternate vendor when some other vendor can't make it. So get on that list and make yourself the best vendor they have ever seen show up at that market in terms of your punctuality and your great-looking stand. Brand yourself. Make sure you have a name that people will remember, and have business cards, have a sign so that people associate that name with your product. Also, always only bring your highest quality product to the market. It doesn't do you any good to sell something that's not absolutely the best. I mean, that sounds pretty obvious, but sometimes you can feel a little desperate and bring a second-grade product, and that's never a good idea.
Right.
Remember your customers' names. About a third of my business comes from my regular customers that come every week. They're my base, and if I didn't have them, it would be a lot harder to be there every week.
Well, this is
those are kind of some of the main things.
Awesome. This is a really awesome book. There's a whole chapter in there on getting to know your farm from house to field. There's a chapter on the healthy farmer, keeping your mind, body, and spirit safe,
healthy,
and happy. Yes. In 30 seconds, can you just tell me what's been your biggest challenge? What's been the biggest bonus?
Well, I think part of the biggest challenge is getting used to, I'm alone a lot.
Right.
So sometimes when I go out, I think I've forgotten how to talk to people during the week. It's like, oh, they're speaking. I spend a lot of time speaking to my cats. So getting used to kind of a more solitary lifestyle, which is okay for me, but it does take some adaptation. So that would be something to get used to. And a tip would be make sure to, because you're alone, even though you're always busy and there's always something else to do and you're always thinking of that next thing that has to be done, make time to spend with your friends or your family. It's so important to have that support with people in your community. Make that time. It come back and reward you 1,000 times over.
Awesome. And you do talk a lot about community in here and the benefit to the community. Audrey Levitino, thank you so much for being with us. The book is called Woman Powered Farm, Manual for a Self-Sufficient Lifestyle from Homestead to Field. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Vicki. This was really wonderful.
And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. You can find me at conversationslive.net. You can also find us at info@conversationslive.net. If you have questions or comments on today's show, would like any information about any of our guests, you can find it there. You can also reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. And of course, you can find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. So we'll be back next week with an all live news show. And I want to thank you for being with us today. I thought it's kind of an interesting tie-in today because we were talking about futures in the beginning and then we go into Christie's new future and her book, and one of her characters happens to be a farmer, and then we end with a woman-powered farm. So everybody had a great some great information today, I think, and they've all carved out their own unique careers and lifestyles that work for them. So thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.